Well, thank you,
Derek. Thank you, Roger. Thank you, the musicians. Thank you, John. We're going to be looking at 1 Peter this morning. If you want a Bible, Ron's got a great pile. Put your hand up and one will come. Love so amazing, so divine. Isn't that great? Demands my soul, my life, my all. Knew somebody many years ago who used to insist on singing "Can Have" in the last, instead of "Demands," "Can Have My Life." It's a great song. God is a good God. And this morning we're going to be looking at living stones. Maybe God will bless us and give us something to take away with us. I trust so. 1 Peter chapter 2 verse 4. I don't have a page in the church Bible, but Peter comes towards the end of the Bible after James. After 1218. Thanks, Liz. As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by men but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For in Scripture it says, "See, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone, and the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame." Now to you who believe, this stone is precious. But to those who do not believe, the stone the builders rejected has become the capstone, and a stone that causes men to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. They stumble because they disobey the message, which is also what they were destined for. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Dear friends, I urge you, as aliens and strangers in the world, to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. Got a couple of pictures here. 2 piles of stones. You may recognise one. It has a resemblance to Castle Bridge. It is Castle Bridge. And one, by virtue of its design and the skill of the masons who built it, has a purpose in mind. It has, in fact, 2 purposes, really. One is to carry the trucks and vehicles and people across the top so that they don't have to go through the river. And the other is to allow the river to carry on flowing. And it's designed to resist the strength of the current of the river that flows beneath it. And its ability to carry out, this is simple stuff really, its ability to carry out that purpose comes from the skill of those that designed it, the engineers, the stonemasons who were involved in building the bridge in the first place. I don't know how many years ago that was. Now you see that the bridge is formed of a lot of individual stones, each one different. Some you can't see, some are buried down in the foundations, under the water, under the land, but still carrying out a job. Some form the arch. They work closely with those either side of them to give the bridge its strength to span the river and carry the loads that are running across it. There are other stones up at the top, fancy ones on the parapet that stop people falling in when they're walking across the top. Lots of different stones, all working together for a purpose. And individually, they remain individuals, but collectively, they're a bridge. And in fact, you probably thought bridge before you thought stones when you looked at the picture. Now, the other picture shows a kind of a random pile of stones on the seashore somewhere. They also are individual stones. Each one has a different shape, a different size. But they don't have any kind of collective form. You might say that they're kind of free. They're not tied down in the way that the bridge is. They're free to move around. They may enjoy the company of somebody nearby for a while. Might even form quite a close relationship. But then they're loose, you see. And when the storm comes and the tide comes in, crisis comes, there's no collective strength to resist what comes against them. And suddenly relationships are abandoned and they move on. There's no kind of enduring purpose. They drift wherever the wind and the tide and the wave takes them. So, two sets of stones. What can we learn? How can we apply this to us? What would God like from us? Peter here is writing to the Jewish Christians, and he picks up a couple of Old Testament references here from Isaiah and from the Psalms. And he also probably has in mind the time when Jesus left the temple with his disciples. Peter would have been amongst them. And he talked about the temple being pulled down and being destroyed and how he was going to rebuild it. See, the temple in Jerusalem was hugely significant to the Jews. It was the symbol, really, of God's promise to them as a nation. It was the foundation, the cornerstone, you might say, of their identity as a nation. It was also the centre of their religious beliefs. It was the place where God was to be worshipped. And on top of all that, it was an architectural masterpiece. You remember the comments of one of the disciples, "Look, teacher, what massive stones, what magnificent buildings." But Jesus came and instituted a new covenant, a new promise. God would no longer live in a temple made with stone, made with timber, made with gold. The cloud had moved out. There was no cloud on the temple when we sang about that earlier on, didn't we? The glory of God came down on the temple many, many centuries before. But it was as if by that stage God had moved out. And spiritually the temple was empty and deserted and really could be discarded, which was why Jesus said it would be torn down. But for the Jews and for the Jewish Christians that Peter was writing to, the concept of God kind of living in a building, in a something made of stone, was deep in their thought, and he builds on that here. But he introduces this idea of living stones. We are the temple, God's new temple, the living stones, and at the centre of it, the cornerstone, is Jesus, the living stone, the living stone, rejected by men but chosen by God. So living stones, living structures made of living stones. You, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house. A holy priesthood is what Peter writes here. Now, I think for me, both these piles of stones represent Christians. It's not that the bridge is made of living stones and that these are dead stones, and somehow God picks up dead stones and makes them into living stones and chips the corners off and makes them the right shape and slots them into a structure. I think these pictures illustrate two types of Christian, which is really what I felt we need to consider for ourselves. Where do we lie? Because it's not actually, they're not two, maybe they're two extremes. There's a spectrum between the two. And what God seems to be bringing out very clearly in this series, and this is the second, if you remember, Ian spoke 2 weeks ago, and if you are here, if you will be here in the next week and the week after, very strong sense of community coming out in the passages that we have. What is God saying to us about community and how we work together in structures? Because it's pretty clear that with the bridge, you've got something where the total, the whole, is greater than the sum of the parts. And I think that's a key thing in what God builds. And when you look at, from the outside, when you look at the top, as I said before, you don't see pile of stones, you see bridge. It's important to remember that we, then, are the living stones. But because we're living, breathing human beings and not inanimate lumps of rock, we're different, obviously, to stones. And whether we're in the top, in the bridge, or whether we're in the pile at the bottom, we've still got all the attributes and gifts that God has given us as Christians. He saved us, we've got his salvation, we've got our own free will and to determine what we do. He hasn't made us robots. We can choose where we fit into this, whether we allow God to slot us into a structure, or whether we want to be a little bit distant, whether we want to disengage. Now the thing is that because we're living stones, these kind of structures, I'll call them the structures, it's fluid. Stones can move around because they're living. To expand your picture here in your own mind. And in many ways, stones can actually be part of two structures at the same time. The same person could be a key in two things that God's doing. In the same way, God may take a stone out of one building, one structure, and slot it into another. He may disengage you from here. He may send you across the world and plug you in somewhere else. I guess there's times you can let your mind run on with parallels, really. But there are times, aren't there, where key stones are suddenly removed. And you think, oh, will the structure fall? Sometimes the structure does fall. And you're left with stones which then God can rebuild into other structures. It's not a disaster. Just maybe not the best. Other times God brings other stones in to fill the places that are left when he moves people on. So there's a fluidity there in what happens within the structures that God builds. Where do we fit into that? Where do we see ourselves today? And our situations change, don't they? Sometimes things are great. Sometimes we're stuck in up to our necks. Other times things happen and we become a little bit disengaged. We find ourselves a little bit distant. Things aren't maybe as we'd like. So you can move between the two extremes. I don't know. We have to decide where we are today. It doesn't matter in one sense, because God's grace remains the same wherever we are. There's grace for people who are just in a pile without being slotted into a structure. God's love doesn't change. That's the wonderful thing about God. His grace is the same. But there's a danger. There's a danger of drifting as the tide moves in, as winds change. There's a danger of moving around without anchor, without a direction, without a shape. And when people look in from the world outside on us or on you, Do they see a random stone or do they see a structure? Whenever we come across Castle Bridge every time we come to church from where we live, and quite often there are people on there looking at the castle. You can see the castle, actually, can't you, through there. Another great pile of stones. But people stop and they say, you know, wow, isn't that magnificent? And it is. But it's just a pile of stones, really. So as people look in on us, what do they see? Do they see things random? Or do they say, wow, isn't that magnificent? We need to decide where we stand at the moment and ask God, if we're willing, ask God to slot us in somewhere where he wants us. We are a living stone. We need to be subject to his building skills, his craftsmanship, so that we become more than what we would otherwise be. Verse 9. This is a great affirmation, a great encouragement. You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Just look at the words that he wrote. Now you are a chosen people. You are. It's not a you will be. It's not a promise. It's something which is established in heaven. You are a chosen people. Jeff mentioned Barack Obama, didn't he, in his prayer. Barack Obama is the president of the USA. You are a chosen people. Dwell on these words. Just let's look at them. A royal priesthood. The priesthood, you remember, in the Old Testament was the people who could go into the temple, into the presence of God. They were a special people. An honoured office it was to be a priest. And you are royal priest, royal priesthood, the highest rank relating to the king, the monarch, the queen. The rank is the highest, a royal priesthood. A holy nation. A nation is a group of people who live under the authority of a single king, a single government. That is what a nation is. This is a holy nation. This is the kingdom of God. Holy means kind of set aside, devoted. We're a nation, a group of people set aside, devoted to God. A royal priesthood, a holy nation belonging to God. A people belonging to God is what is written here. Owned by God, bought by him, possessed by him. This is the great affirmation, the great encouragement for us in these words. So we need to grab hold of these truths and set our sights on them and allow ourselves to be formed by the master stonemason, by the master craftsman, to be built into one of his structures, or many of them. In a sense, the church is the overarching thing that God is building from stones. Of course it is. But within the church, there are a lot of substructures. There's a lot of things going on which we're called to be part of, which God will build us into. That, as it says later on, that they, those outside, may see our good deeds and glorify God on the day that he visits us. Now, I've got a couple of illustrations here. Which I want to share with you. One is something that goes on in the church here. One comes from across the world, comes from Malawi actually. Showing what God is building, what God is doing, and maybe out of that we can see how we can fit into these things. On Tuesday evening at our house group, Jane and Michelle and Celia shared with us about the pod and the work that they do down there every Thursday night with a group of others, and in particular about some of the young lads and lasses who come regularly and some of their difficulties and some of their problems. And what stood out to me really is the enormous gulf between my own privileged, secure upbringing, very middle class. There's a huge gulf between that and the socially stressed situation that so many of these young folk find themselves in, that they face daily. One of them asked Jane quite a haunting question. Said, "Are all Christians rich?" You can't answer that. Well, don't answer that question. But think what he sees of us. What was it that made him ask that question? What are his perceptions of those who go and work every Thursday night down at the pod? Because they find themselves kind of excluded from the world that's around them, the world they see in Warwick, the world they see streaming out of the television day by day. And they are at serious risk of being sucked into things that maybe seem to them to offer them a way out, a way through. Indeed, some of them are already sort of at the edges of the whirlpool of petty crime and drug abuse and things like that. It's a great challenge. And deep down, we know and are convinced that Jesus has an answer for them. Jesus, we know, has a power to change lives and to change situations. We were called out of darkness into his wonderful light, and so he can do for those young folk. The team that go down there on a Thursday night, in a way, are Jesus to those boys and girls. And for the rest of us, the exhortation was to pray. And we can all do that. And in that way, we can become a stone, a pod stone, you could say, part of what goes on. There are those, I know, who are committed every Thursday night to pray, but it's easy. All you've got to do, I guess, is to set the alarm on your mobile phone or something, 7:30, Thursday night, and pray. And boy, do they need it. They had a really rough time last Thursday. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. There's lots of other times you could set your mobile phone alarm to pray. There's Monday mornings with toddlers, there's Friday nights with Activate and Counterflow and all these other things that go on. There's the Ladies Fellowship on Wednesdays. There's so many things go on. Your phone will be buzzing all day long, and you can pray continuously, like we are exhorted to do. But this is, it's a way that we can become part of what God's doing. We can be a foundation stone, maybe buried under the river, but nonetheless part of what he's doing. Second illustration comes from an article in the Times just before Christmas. I did share this with one or two folk, but it was written by one of their columnists, not a believer, who travelled to Africa to see the work of Pump Aid, which was one of the charities that the Times was supporting as part of their Christmas appeal. And the article starts like this, if you can believe it. "As an atheist, I truly believe Africa needs God. Missionaries, not aid money, are the solution to Africa's biggest problem, the crushing passivity of the people's mindset." He develops his argument through the article, and I'll let you have details of it if you want to read it. But here are some extracts. "I've become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in Africa, sharply distinct from the work of secular NGOs, government projects, and international aid efforts. These alone will not do. Education and training alone will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is good. This time in Malawi, I met no missionaries. You do not account to missionaries in the lobbies of expensive hotels discussing development strategy documents as you do the big NGOs. But instead, I noticed that a handful of the most impressive African members of the Pompeii team, largely from Zimbabwe, were privately strong Christians. Privately, because the charity is entirely secular, and I've never heard any of the team so much as mention religion while working in the villages. But I picked up the Christian references in our conversations. One I saw was studying a devotional textbook in the car. One on Sunday went off at church at dawn, to church at dawn for a two-hour service. It would suit me to believe that their honesty, diligence, and optimism in their work was unconnected with a personal faith. Their work was secular, but surely affected by what they were. What they were was, in turn, influenced by a conception of man's place in the universe that Christianity had taught. Amazing, isn't it? This is an atheist, confessed atheist, observing. An illustration of verse 12. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. Summary then. Where do we lie between these two extremes? At the moment, I mean, as I say, we can move. God wants to encourage us to be part of what he's doing, to be built in to one or many of the things, of the structures that he's building, so that we can be worthwhile. We can have direction, that people looking in from the outside will see and will glorify God. Let's deliberately put ourselves at God's disposal and be built into one of the things that he is building. We're going to sing before we close. Let's finish with a great song of praise, one of these old hymns that I'm quite fond of. To God be the glory. Great things he has done. Perfect redemption. The purchase of blood to every believer, the promise of God. Full of great wonder, this song. Let's stand and sing it at the top of our voices, and then we'll close.